3. Tones of voice. My view is far too complicated to explain in a poem. E.J. Thribb. Lines on the Return to Britain of Billy Graham. Master Thribb, the English satirical magazine, privatized spoof schoolboy poet, clearly thinks that poetry is not the appropriate vehicle to do justice to the intricacies of his views on religion. Whether or not some subject matter is beyond the capacities of verse, we can readily see that the tone struck by a poem needs to be appropriate to its content. Our merriment in reading E.J. Thribb comes from enjoying the disparity either between the dignity of his chosen topics and the banal inertia of his verse, or between the ambition to write high-flown verse and the trivial character of his concerns. It is exactly the disjunction that all parody uses to gain its effect. And by recognizing the incongruity, we are also reminded of the importance of an appropriate fit between subject and tone of voice. I use the term tone of voice in this chapter for two reasons. First, in reading poetry, we often have the impression that the poet is speaking to us. This is partly because of the long association of poetry with the spoken word. But more specifically, because the predominant poetic mode has become one in which one person is telling, or singing to us, often about emotional experience. This lyric mode fosters a sense of intimacy, and is the model we also see in words set to music, from Schubert to the popular songs of our own day. As I shall show later, this notion of how a poem speaks needs serious qualification. The second reason, however, is that there are respects in which the system of tones adopted by poems can be equated to those we employ in daily speech. It is this variety that I want to explore in this chapter. Ways of speaking. In conversation, we adopt different ways of speaking according to circumstance and to whom we are speaking. To people we know well, we will speak more elusively, drawing upon shared knowledge and assumptions, whereas with strangers or in more formal situations, we might strive to be more explicit and precise in our vocabulary and sentence structure. We always work with a loose system of formalities, adjusting how we say things according to the situation. For instance, we may only use that kind of intonation of our voice which aims to tell the listener that we mean the opposite of what we are saying. For example, remarking, "lovely day," when it is cold and raining, if we are confident that they will understand what we really mean. In many languages, the same part of speech can mean entirely different things depending on how the spoken sound is pitched. English does not work like that. Although contouring the sound ironically, as in "lovely day," is part of the way we pitch the tone of our speech. Indeed, intonation can generate meaning all by itself. Think how many ways there are of saying yes and no. These have their counterparts in many kinds of writing. As we shall see later, the stress patterns of the verse line are a special resource for deploying pitch of this kind. Linguists often use the term register when picking out the formalities appropriate to speaking to various audiences. And in this chapter, I want to argue that we can see the different subgenres of poetry as registers of this kind. The lament for the dead in an elegy, the inwardness and song-like qualities of the lyric, the wryness or vituperation of the satire, and the considered mixture of public and private concern in the ode. All these are examples of how the traditional modes of poetry have evolved to fit a tone of voice composed of word choice, rhythm, and shape to the appropriate occasion. Employing the resources of such modes is akin to finding the appropriate way to speak in public, or to a friend, whether in celebration, condolence, gossip, or any other situation. Natural and unnatural. Now it can be objected that emphasizing the place of traditional modes denies the spontaneity or naturalness of poetry. This takes us back to that valued association between the verse and the poet as speaker. The American poet, Kenneth Rexrox, 1905-82, stated that, "I have spent my life trying to write the way I talk." Rexroth evidently thought that his verse should approximate in tone to the way he talked. Presumably, he valued the idea of consonance between these different speech acts. Indeed, different parts of his personality. Since we tend to think of our ordinary speech as natural, it seems obvious that he wanted to cleanse his verse of artificial expression. Interestingly, however, since Rexroth says that he has spent his life on this quest, it seems that the pursuit of the natural is not easy. Settling to work upon a poem, he encounters an expectation for a certain specialized language and manner, acting strongly upon him. Although he speaks every day of his life, it is a lifetime's work to write in just the way he speaks. If this suggests that natural is not in fact so natural, it does not eclipse the long-standing demand for poetry to achieve a tone close to everyday speech. What William Wordsworth, 1770-1850, called the speech of ordinary men. Wordsworth was reacting against a poetic manner that he thought had become stultifying, and the changes of poetic styles have often been driven simply by an intuitive sense that poetry can't work that way anymore, a sense that is often related to how close or how distant poetry and common speech should be. But we should recognize that in speech too, audience and occasion will usually influence, even determine, the tenor of how we talk, and that within these conventions, we will choose our words. There is then no simple distinction here between the natural and the artificial. Artifice, by which I mean considered making, is not only unavoidable, it is natural. None of this is to say that the time will not come when impatience with set forms, transgression, innovation, and irreverence will be as appropriate and necessary in poems as they are in life. But we can ask whether an ordinary tone is what we want in poetry. Might we not want extraordinary speech, choice of words, a diction that we do not encounter every day? At present, after more than half a century in which the informal, the conversational, and the unpoetic manner has dominated poetry in English, we might think so. The following discussion of the different registers that have been used over the preceding centuries might help us decide. Authority and authenticity. In considering the different classifications of poetry, as tones of voice, I shall be making a broad division between public and personal registers. But in both spheres, and of course they are not wholly distinct, one aspect of the voice is bound to concern us. As we encounter a poem, we will pick up a tone and want to ask, as we do mentally or explicitly with an unexpected phone call, "Who is speaking here?" We ask this not in the literal biographical sense, but in search of assurance as to the authority of the voice. That is, whether we want to give it our trust. This might mean trusting the poem to tell us a story with a secure grasp of its plot, and with compelling establishment of description and character. It might mean being confident that the ideas the poem contains are intelligible and substantial, rather than arrantly prejudiced. It might mean being convinced that the emotional world of the poem is plausibly and affectingly conveyed. None of these things necessarily depends upon our knowing the poet's credentials, in the sense that she or he was an eyewitness to events, or a profound philosopher, or actually experienced the pain or joy described. Authenticity in a poem is a matter of rhetoric, of how the poet draws us into trust, and makes us inhabit the events, ideas, or emotions of the poem as we read. Finally, this is done only by the words themselves on the page and in the ear. Of course, as with all trusting, we might come to feel we were misled. Public voices. Although we now often see poetry as the most intimate of the literary genres, through most of its history, it has worked as a public medium. Yet again, this has to do with its oral origins, the transmission of the poem by voice to an audience. Narrative, as we have seen with the ballad, is the most obvious of poetry's traditional functions, and storytelling has been the principal purpose of poetry, or significant component of it, for centuries. In his massive collection, The Canterbury Tales, Geoffrey Chaucer, 1340 to 1400, makes the pleasure and purpose of storytelling the very method and substance of his work. The host of Southwark's Tabard Inn, from which Chaucer's varied company of characters will leave on their pilgrimage to the shrine of St. Thomas à Becket at Canterbury, exhorts each of them to tell a tale or two along the way, as the ride will be cheerless if they ride the way dumb as stone. He himself will give a free dinner as the prize for the best story. "That is to say, that telleth in this case, tales of best sentence and most solace. Prologue 1, 797-8. Sentence here encompasses theme and significance, and solace, amusement and pleasure. But there is another dimension to this double purpose that Chaucer takes pains to set out, and that is his aim to represent the tale of each of his companions exactly as spoken. Of course, this is a fiction, but it is a significant one, and his bold apology for it is significant. "For this ye known all so well as I. Whoso shall tell a tale after a man, he moot rehearse as nigh as ever he can. Rehearse near, everych a word, if it be in his charge, every. I'll speak, he never so rudelich and large, rudely, or else he moot tell his tale untrue, or feign thine, or feigned words new, pretend. He may not spare, although he were his brother, flinch. He moot as well say a word as another. Christ's back himself, full broad, in holy writ, and well you would know, villainy, is it, you know." Prologue 1, 730-40. Gloss. "You know as well as I that anyone who repeats another's tale must keep as close as he can to each and every word, no matter how crude they might be, or else he is being untruthful, pretending and putting in new words. He must not flinch from that, even to save his brother's blushes, but say one word as straight as another. After all, in the Bible Christ spoke broadly, and as you know, there's nothing unfit in that." The poet claims that being true to what is actually said, and how it is said, even if the words are rudelich and large, is his first duty, even if this villainy offends against decorum. His license to do this, he takes from the Gospels, in which Christ himself speaks full broad. The register of the Canterbury Tales, then is presented as natural speech. Implicitly, the work is setting itself apart from literary decorum. In the 1300s, too, it was important that the work is in the English tongue rather than the more prestigious Latin or French. The poem is declaring itself for a middle style of verse, one that will include voices of various social degrees in the context of convivial, improvised storytelling. Yet Chaucer is assigning himself a greater task, because this naturalistic effect needs to vary according to the different manners of his narrators. It is striking how often in the brilliant character sketches of the prologue, the poet remarks upon the vocal character and sometimes precise sound of voice of the pilgrims. Thus, the knight's squire is singing or fluting all the day, singing, fluting. The prioress sings the divine service, entuned in her nose, fulsomely, properly refined. The sweet-talking frere's speech is unparalleled for dalliance and fair language, stylish show. Of the fashionable wife of Bath, he writes, in fellowship well could ye she laugh and carp. Part of the social skills that have brought that worthy woman, five husbands, in his cups, the summoner falls into Latin, though only the form of a few cliched tag terms. The venal, arrogant pardoner comes straight fro the court of Rome, is reduced by the observation, a voice he had a, as small as hath a goat. Two contrasting examples might show how Chaucer fits his verse to create the impressions of different registers. Here, the miller, who can barely stay on his horse, brushes aside the reeve to insist on being next after the knight's tale. A challenge to precedent and status, which affects a striking cultural shift in the sequence of the tales in itself, and for which Chaucer affects to apologise. This drunke miller spake full soon again, and said, leave brother Oswald, who hath no wife, he is no cuckold, but I say not therefore that thou art un. There be full good wives many un, many a one, and ever a thousand goody aeons un bade. Thou knowest o well thyself, but if thou mad. The Miller's Prologue, 1:3150-6. Gloss. This drunken miller was soon off again. By your leave, brother Oswald, if a man isn't married, he can't be a deceived husband. Not that I'm saying you're one. There are a thousand good wives for every bad one. You know that yourself, unless you're mad. The ribald quip, that if you don't have a wife, then you can't be cuckolded, is followed by some clumsy verse reeking of inebriation. Trying to speak to ourselves, we find the meter stumble towards the same rhyme word, un, one, a word that also comes up in the next line, putting, thou knowest o well thyself, but if thou madder, into a separate sentence makes it one of those, and another thing, of the buttonholing drunk. A lurching afterthought, banged home with the big stress on madder. The corrupt pardoner, whose handsome living depends upon his seductive eloquence, selling fake pardons and relics to the faithful, begins the preface to his own tale like this. Lordings, quod he, in churches when I preach, I pain me to han a hotine speech, takes pains high flown, and ring it out as round as Guthe bell, for I can by rote that I tell, no by heart. My theme is always un, and ever was. Radix malorum est cupiditas. Love of money is the root of all evil. The Pardoner's Prologue, 1, 329 to 34. "My lords," he said, "when I preach in church, I take pains to use a high-flown kind of speech, and to ring it out clear as a bell, for I've it all by heart. My theme is always and ever has been the same. The love of money is the root of all evil." The haughtiness of his manner is immediately evident, as is his own high opinion of his delivery, which contrasts so clearly with what we have already been told about his goat-like tone. After that first sentence, he rounds off his paragraph with a sophisticated turn by contriving a couplet mixing English and Latin. His choice of Latin text shows an effrontery which anticipates irony, as with so many such characters, the solas. In the pardoner's self-portrayal comes from his outrageousness, and the sentence, in the poet's depiction, of ecclesiastical greed. So, in the different ways Chaucer has these characters speak, we can see their character. The miller's rudelich, roundabout verse, reveals his heedless heartiness, whilst in the pardoner's affected smoothness, we see a condescending superiority, convinced as he is that his audience is too stupid to see through his hypocrisy. In these instances, we see a development of tone that is akin to characterization in dramatic speech. Another simple feature of the Canterbury Tales is the way virtually every tale begins with a geographical placement. The scene may be Oxford, Syria, Holderness, Tartary, or Trumpington, but the audience is always immediately told. Alternatively, the provenance of the tale, for instance, Arthurian legend, or the Roman authors, is announced at the outset, but both procedures serve to situate the audience at once. Thus we know where and when we are, and so are able to take our bearings, to naturalize our experience as the sequence of the tale unfolds. These are two aspects of the voice of the tales: characterization through speech and physical placement, which compose the overall register in which Chaucer endeavours to create a narrative mode suited to actual storytelling before a varied audience. Epic and the Muses. Traditionally, the grandest type of narrative poem is the epic. The model of epic is a large poem whose story is of great historical significance for the group or nation from which it comes. In the Western tradition, Homer's tale of the 10-year war against Troy in the Iliad, and its sequel, the Odyssey, telling of the return home of the hero Odysseus, also known as Ulysses, form the defining myths of the Greek culture from which they sprang. Similarly, Virgil's Latin epic, the Aeneid, which begins with the escape of Aeneas from the ruins of Troy and tells of its hero's wanderings and the eventual fulfillment of his destiny to found the city of Rome, was deliberately composed to recount and sustain the founding myth of the city and its burgeoning empire. For poets setting themselves a narrative task of this magnitude, which calls so much more for sentence than for solace, the issue of authority weighs to an extraordinary degree. How can a single mind embrace the historical span and spiritual significance of a people's identity, and also have the technical skill to engage and excite an audience? Traditionally, the answer is inspiration. Our common notion of inspiration is of an idea or sense of possibility that comes to us individually and unbidden without conscious mental process, as though from elsewhere. The classical poets looked to the gods and to the muses for aid, and in the Middle Ages, the Italian poet Dante, 1265 to 1321, lost in the dark wood of doubt and depression, recounts how he is sent divine assistance to enable him to start his imaginary journey and thus his poem. Occasionally, the muse's assistance is sought in drama, as when the prologue in William Shakespeare's 1564-1616, King Henry V yearns for reality to replace the stage's shadow play. Oh, for a muse of fire that would ascend the brightest heaven of invention, a kingdom for a stage, princes to act, and monarchs to behold the swelling scene. Act 1, Scene 1, 1.1-4. This is a muse of fire, because fire, the lightest of the elements, is associated with poets, whose work aspires upwards towards the spiritual realm. For us, the important thing about poetry that presents itself in this manner is that the poets are acknowledging that the process of composition is not simply an individual matter, but an effort that requires support and is in some sense collective. Whether or not the particular poet literally believes in the touch of a muse, Aphrodite, or the Virgin Mary, he or she is seeking a confidence and authority that transcends their own individual voice. The poet is saying that behind these verses is a weight of precedence and knowledge greater than my own, that I am a channel through which this gathered force of knowledge flows. The epic tone, therefore, aspires to be impersonal. The unnamed figure, clad in a long black cloak, who traditionally spoke Shakespeare's choruses, is therefore an appropriate figure for this register. What lies behind this kind of writing is well shown in the work of perhaps the last writer in English to attempt it with full seriousness, John Milton, 1608-74. In Paradise Lost, Milton sets out to write an epic in the classical manner, but even more adventurously in English rather than either of the anciently prestigious languages of Latin or Greek. The poem will retell the foundation story of the Judeo-Christian religion, the loss of innocence of the human race through Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. For Europeans of Milton's time, there could be no greater story, and since it is told in the sacred text of the Book of Genesis, Milton's attempt could well be seen as presumptuous in the extreme. Milton is aware of this, referring to his poem as "My Adventurous Song, that with no middle flight intends to soar above the Aeonian mount, while it pursues things unattempted yet in prose or rhyme." Paradise Lost 1, 1.13-16. In these early lines, Milton is doing two things. He is invoking the assistance of the muses and of the Christian Holy Spirit as metaphysical aid. He is also girding himself with his palpable awareness and knowledge of the poetic and religious tradition, the Aeonian Mount and other references. But it is also important to Milton as a Christian that he surpasses this classical and pagan literary tradition. The Aeonian Mount is Mount Helicon, in Greek mythology, the sacred home of the muses, and his own poetic flight is going to take him above that. By these devices, he asserts his vision of the transcendence of his religion. He also makes it seem that it is not merely John Milton, born in Bread Street, Cheapside, who sings, but the heavenly muse, who is, by implication, no less than God himself. Hence, things unattempted, yet in prose or rhyme. Midway through the poem, he calls for renewed strength to continue. "Descend from heaven, Urania. By that name, if rightly thou art called, whose voice divine, following above the Olympian hill I saw, above the flight of Pegasian wing. The meaning, not the name I call for thou, nor of the muses nine, nor on the top, of old Olympus dwelt'st, but heavenly born. Before the hills appeared, or foundation flowed, thou with eternal wisdom didst converse, Wisdom thy sister, and with her didst play, in presence of the Almighty Father, pleased, with thy celestial song, upled by thee, into the heaven of heavens I have presumed, an earthly guest, and drawn imperial air, thy tempering. Paradise Lost, 7:1.1-15. These lines are dense with classical and Christian allusion. Once more, he claims to be flying above the Olympian hill, or the height reached by Pegasus, the winged horse of legend. Urania is the Greek muse of astronomy, thus the most heavenly. She was the muse Christian writers adopted for inspiration, and the one Milton calls upon and associates with his own God. All of this is meant to display his knowledge, his humility, and his determination to reach and survive in the most rarefied altitudes of poetry and spirituality. Milton's epic poetic voice is not a singular thing, but a composite of what he saw as proper influences. To adopt Coleridge's metaphor, he has giant's shoulders to mount on, and will thus see further. This is how this author seeks to establish his authority. For all the apparent commands of its manner, Paradise Lost is a poem of embattlement and struggle. It is, after all, a story of loss, of how Adam and Eve's disobedience of God's ban on eating the forbidden fruit brought death into the world, and all our woe. The theme of such momentous loss is common in the grand narratives of the world. It figures, for instance, in a modern poem that can properly be called epic, The Arrivance, by Edward Kamau Brathwaite, 1930-2020, subtitled A New World Trilogy. Its matter is the history and the culture of the Caribbean, a subject which, from the self-styled metropolises of Western culture, might appear marginal, but embodies the massive and enduring themes of a spoiled new world. Migration, transportation, and the effort to find a homecoming. But, unlike Milton, who has those few verses of the Book of Genesis to expand upon, Braithwaite has no set preceding narrative. Instead, he makes his own creation myth for the islands of the Caribbean in the image of a stone thrown across water that skidded arced and bloomed into islands. Curved stone hissed into reef, flashed into spray, Bathsheba, Montego Bay. The scattering implicit in this image can also describe his sources, which are fragments of a lost history, indeed a lost language. The stories and words of the Native American people and of the slaves brought there from Africa. Thus, memories are smoke, lips we can't kiss, hands we can't hold, will never be enough for us. Prelude, The Arrivance, 1973-28. Braithwaite sees about him a shattered history, a contemporary culture split into folk fragments, and marked by the experience of further emigration. Alongside highly formal Western education, for a few, is mass illiteracy. All this means that a single voice is surpassingly difficult to establish. Within the different sections and subsections of his trilogy, therefore, Braithwaite cuts between a great variety of voices, often, as in the lines above, employing a paired, staccato style of stops and starts, as far as possible from the grand progress of Milton's heroic style. Indeed, the first lines of the whole sequence seem to invoke a source in unvoiced sound and image. Drums skin whip, lash, master suns, cutting edge of heat. And it is out of this that the poet says, I sing, I shout, I groan, I dream. To see how different the registers can be in sections barely a page apart, we can compare these passages from the third book of the trilogy, Islands, in a section called Ancestors, The first is a simple, apparently autobiographical, recollection. Every Friday morning, my grandfather left his farm of cane fields, chickens, cows, and rattled in his trap down to the harbour town to sell his meat. He was a butcher. This matter-of-fact voice shifts into a dreamier remembrance of his grandmother telling us stories round her fat white lamp. And in the night, I listened to her singing, in a Vicks and vapour rub, like voice that you would call the blues. Three, come a look. Come a look, see what happen. Come a look, see what happen. Suki dead, Suki dead, Suki dead-o. Lines 239-40. The subject of the arrivance is too large and various to be covered in one register alone. Milton strove for an encompassing English voice, believing that he could render the true interpretation of scripture to his people. For Braithwaite, there is no scripture for his subject. Instead, there are fragmentary histories, songs, murmurings, intuitions, and memories like smoke. Thus, the poem comprises many styles and tones, some jagged and furious, others ruminative, some descriptive, others in song. Often, as in passages quoted, the poem moves quite suddenly between the different kinds of English, included in what Braithwaite himself has called the prism of languages. Public anger and satire. In view of its subject matter, it is not surprising that an angry note is often struck in the arrivance. But this is no modern novelty. Historically, poetry has frequently been scorched by anger, and whilst we might readily assume that this might be an eruptive, unbridled phenomenon, it can be related once more to the association poetry has with those deliberate styles of public speaking known as rhetoric. In classical rhetoric, there were ways of getting mad. In Latin, vituperatio, vituperation, was a special, calculated mode of speech to express fury. In this poem, D.H. Lawrence, 1885 to 1930, may simply seem to be stamping his foot, but in fact he does so in time. It takes its title from the first line. How beastly the bourgeoisie is, especially the male of the species. Presentable, eminently presentable. Shall I make you a present of him? Oh, but wait. Let him meet a new emotion. Let him be faced with another man's need. Let him come home with a bit of moral difficulty. Let life face him with a new demand on his understanding. Then watch him go soggy, like a wet meringue. Watch him turn into a mess, either a fool or a bully. Just watch the display of him, confronted with a new demand on his intelligence, a new life demand. Lawrence is clearly angry, but the rage is not inchoate. Structurally, the poet marshals it into a series of anaphoric clauses. Let him, watch him, together with those alliterated B sounds, and the refrain, how beastly the bourgeoisie is, especially the male of the species. These are stock rhetorical devices, often heard in speeches by which the orator seizes the ear. Of course, the vituperative mode might often speak direct to the object of disgust, rather than, as here, to a supposed third person. Perhaps, however, Lawrence was being disingenuous. Perhaps he suspected that a good part of his contemporary readers will start to wonder, might he mean me? Such wiliness is not the most full-on manner of vituperation, though it is outspoken, enraged, and brooks no qualification. A subtler, more extensive version of the critical register is satire. The traditional targets of satire are pride and presumption, and the satirist's stance is that of the undeceived observer, who relentlessly spies the gap between pretension and reality. The serious satirist has a philosophical view of the limitations of humankind, and is enraged by the spectacle of fellow creatures who persist in vanity and self-deception of every kind. In this poem, the anonymous Miss W is provoked by the calumny on women she has seen in John Swift's 1667 to 1745 scatological poem, The Lady's Dressing Room. Swift had chronicled, in stomach-churning detail, the realization of a particularly soppy lover, that far from being the ethereal creature he had imagined her to be, that his lady, Cecilia shits. In the gentleman's study, Miss W retaliates with an equally scabrous denunciation of the habits of the male sex. She concludes, "Ladies, you'll think 'tis admirable that this to all men's applicable, and though they dress in silk and gold, could you their insides but behold, there you fraud, lies, deceit would see, and pride and base impiety. So let them dress the best they can, they still are fulsome, wretched man." Although here Miss W means the male sex by man, her insistence is upon the chasm between appearance and reality. Dress hides nothing from the satirist's X-ray eye. It is because of this disparity that the ironic tone features so prominently in satire of all kinds. Irony is the mode in which what is said is the opposite of what is meant. For example, when the songwriter Randy Newman, 1943 to date, croons, "Short people got no reason to live," we are taken aback until we recognise that he is making a proposition he knows to be ludicrous in order to mock prejudice. Ironic effect often involves such a time lag between our first hearing the idea and realising its true meaning. Rather, as in any wind-up joke, in verse, the couplet is a device particularly suited to such delayed revelation of the underlying truth. A couplet is a pair of successive rhyming lines, and our wait is what the second rhyming word will be, is an interval that can be exploited. Mary Barber's 1690 to 1757, An Unanswerable Apology for the Rich, takes this ironic tone in sympathising with the wealthy Castalio. "No man alive would do more good, or give more freely if he could. He grieves whene'er the wretched sue, but what can poor Castalio do? Would heaven but send 10,000 more, he'd give, just as he did before." The apology is, of course, a caustic condemnation of Castalio's lack of charity. We are led to wonder if he would be more generous if he had yet more money. But when told he would as he did before, we realise that means he would do nothing. In these next lines, in which Alexander Pope, 1688 to 1744, sardonically skewers the casual habits of judges and jurors, we see the couplet deployed to full effect. "Meanwhile, declining from the noon of day, the sun obliquely shoots his burning ray. The hungry judges soon the sentence sign, and wretches hang, that jurymen may dine." Although the comfortable progress of the first two lines is becoming disrupted by the signing of the sentence, and especially the image of hanging, it is not until the last syllable that the full import of his complaint is clear. The wretches are off to the scaffold because the court wants its dinner. The passage comes to a point, and what is distinctive about the satiric register is its acuteness. The wit to produce surprise in which things become instantly clear is the successful verse satirist's weapon. But the stance is not without its dangers, for seeming to be so perspicacious, so certain, and so ready to mock and correct, opens such writers to charges of presumption and simple peevishness, deciding what, in the poet's tone, is properly critical, and what is merely spiteful, is one of the difficulties and fascinations of reading satire. Pastoral and simple speaking, concerned as it is with foibles and manners, often as symptoms of a greater malaise, satire is the most social of poetic modes. Pastoral, by contrast, is a form which criticizes worldly sophistication not by pillorying it, but by staying apart from it. The notion of pastoral goes back to classical Greece and the poet Theocritus, reckoned to have been at work around 270 BC. It claims its source and inspiration from the simple songs of shepherds, which is why the reed pipe, Milton's oaten flute, in his pastoral elegy, Lycidas, is its familiar emblem. But this attribution should not be taken literally, for pastoral is largely a feigned form, a style employed by poets as a means to criticize their own sophisticated society by contrasting it with the unaffected virtues of the humble shepherd's life. It is also a mode through which poets can seek another kind of idealized return to a simpler, less elaborate manner of writing. For Milton, the pastoral was the style for the poetic beginner, but for Wordsworth, certainly at the outset of his career, it is, like the ballad, an ideal in itself. For him, it respects the unnoticed lives of the rural poor, and provides a purified diction for poetry based in ordinary language. Here, in We Are Seven, the voice can sound determinedly straightforward. I met a little cottage girl. She was 8 years old, she said. Her hair was thick with many a curl that clustered round her head. The short lines, alternating between 4 and 3 beats, the predominant use of monosyllables, of familiar words, and the unremarkable nature of what is described, all go to comprise a register that is defiantly plain. It is indeed a kind of anti-poetry. Elsewhere, and increasingly as his career goes on, Wordsworth does develop a more elaborated style using the longer, unrhymed, and blank verse line of Milton, whom he revered. But in his pastoral manner, he had first worked to strip and simplify his style to create a voice that sounds closer to that of the subjects and characters in his poems. Thus, he does not seem to be speaking from the mountain of poetic tradition, and his authority might appear less forbidding. Indeed, in We Are Seven, we hear the encounter of two voices, the poet and the cottage girl, as she insists, against adult rationality, that there are 7 in her family, including the ones living away and the 2 who in the churchyard lie. Her view of the world confounds her senior. It is a poem in which Wordsworth seeks to dismantle his own and others' educated authority. A similar turn towards the simple voice can be seen in 20th century modernist poetry. William Carlos Williams, 1883-1963, was an American poet writing in urban New Jersey, about as far from the life of humble shepherds as you can get. But he sought to write about the daily life in the streets about him, in a deliberately simple way, and he titled several of his poems Pastoral. This poem, The Raper from Passenach, published in 1935, is in this style. I refuse. You'll find me dead in bed. First. Why not? That's the way she spoke. I wish I could shoot him. How would you like to know a murderer? I may do it. For Williams, the development of this manner was involved with how he felt he related or did not relate, to the accepted poetic tradition. "From the beginning I felt I was not English," he wrote. "If poetry had to be written, I had to do it in my own way. I wanted to write a poem," 1958, page 14. In 1913, he had begun a poem, homage, like this, "Elvira, by Love's Grace. There goeth before you a clear radiance, which maketh all vain souls candles when noon is." Here, clearly, he was using a voice that he thinks is the one appropriate to verse, but one foreign to his sensibility. His shedding of that manner is a search for authenticity, a simple, natural style not governed by precedent. But, as with Wordsworth, the style serves immediate, unsung subjects. These lines are from one of those he called pastoral, in which he is walking through a poor district. The fences and outhouses, built of barrel staves and parts of boxes, all, if I am fortunate, smeared a bluish green that, properly weathered, pleases me best of all colours. In I Wanted to Write a Poem, Williams later described what he was doing like this. "The rhythmic unit is not measured by capitals at the beginning of a line, or periods within the lines. The rhythmic unit usually came to me in a lyrical outburst. I wanted it to look that way on the page. I didn't go in for long lines because of my nervous nature. I couldn't. The rhythmic pace was the pace of speech, an excited pace, because I was excited when I wrote. I was discovering pressed by some violent mood. The lines were short, not studied. I Wanted to Write a Poem, page 15. Personal voices. It is clear in this discussion of the pastoral register how we have come back to the notion of the distinctively individual voice, and Rex Roth's ideal of writing in a way one speaks. Williams uses the phrase lyrical outburst. As we saw in chapter 1, lyrical poetry has its origins in song, an important sense which survives in the term song lyrics. But as this kind of poetry has evolved, it has also come to refer to poems which carry an immediately felt emotion, compulsively expressed. The lyric has become predominantly the medium for the personal voice. This is an anonymous lyric known, with its music, from the early 16th century, though it may be older. "Western wind, when wilt thou blow, Western? The small rain down can rain. Christ, if my love were in my arms, and I in my bed again." We know nothing of the circumstances surrounding this poem, but the melancholy atmosphere created by the image of wind and rain takes us into the speaker's sadness. When the rhythmic surge of the exclamation "Christ," followed by the stresses on the two key words "love" and "arms," carries us into the sense of loss and longing. It is an exact, simple example of that immediately felt emotion compulsively expressed. And to convey that immediacy is its whole burden. If we, as listeners or readers, feel this, it comes entirely from these particular words, not from anything we know outside of them. But we could not claim that these lines are ordinary speech. There is obvious artifice in the use of the image of rain and wind, in the metrical beat, and in the use of rhymes. These are what comprise the lyric's musical qualities. The poem may be felt, and we may feel its emotion, but it is composed. This, I believe, is the essential quality of the lyric of emotion, that it can convey its sincerity through artifice. We might see this working in an idiom much closer to our own, in this contemporary lyric by the songwriter Nick Cave, 1957 to date. It is a love song called Into My Arms, and the phrase Into My Arms, O Lord, is its refrain. It is hard to think of a few words that can more directly convey a lover's simple longing. But the song also has a more elaborate scheme. It begins,
I don't believe in an interventionist God, but I know, darling, that you do. But if I did, I would kneel down and ask him, not to intervene when it comes to you, not to touch a hair of your head, to leave you as you are. If he felt he had to direct you, then direct you into my arms. Into my arms, O Lord. Into my arms, O Lord. Into my arms, O Lord. Into my arms, O Lord.
The lyrical longing is powerfully there, but built around it is this pondering about belief in a God who steps into our lives. It becomes a prayer, though one perhaps uttered with tongue in cheek, since it is phrased conditionally. If I did believe, if he felt he had to direct you. The song is intriguing because of its mixture of love longing and a weighty religious idea, and the possibility that the singer is playing with both these elements, ironically. When we recognize this complexity, two questions might occur. First, is he sincere? We might answer that by trying to research the song's background in Nick Cave's life, or some other aspect of its sources. But if, as it is, the song is performed by someone else, how can we know if the singer is sincere? Of course, we don't expect performers to have felt and experienced everything they sing, but to rely on tracking back from the singer to what we might discover about the composer's life or sources is surely a convoluted approach to evaluating our response to hearing the lyric. First and foremost, we must enter the little world the song creates for us, and be convinced and entertained by that alone. If we are to connect it to a real life, let it be our own. Second, is its felt emotion undermined by the song's construction around the religious idea? Is it too blatantly artificial? If we think that sincerity depends upon conveying a direct, unambiguous feeling as simply as possible, then perhaps so. If, however, we think it might include shades of feeling and its complication by ideas about that feeling, as I believe Cave's song does, then no, all verbal expression involves artifice. The personal voice of Cave's lyric is the more interesting and enjoyable because of its complexity of structure and feeling. But here is a spanner for these works. Long after, I had formulated my own reading and ideas about Cave's song as set out here. I heard him tell an interviewer that the subject of the song was not in fact a lover, but his own father. How does that information affect your reading? Person and persona. It was largely because of the too ready association of the I in the poem and the I who is the author that some poets have cast their poems in the voice of distinct, named characters. This strategy of the dramatic monologue is used most notably by Robert Browning, 1812-89, in such poems as My Last Duchess, Andrea del Sarto, and The Bishop Orders His Tomb. All these have Italian Renaissance settings. And so, while the poems feature an I speaking to us, the reader recognizes the distance from Browning when his Fra Lippo Lippi, painter and monk, says, You understand me, I'm a beast I know. Modernist poets of the early 20th century, especially keen to break the identification of the individual poet with what is spoken in the poem, adapted Browning's example. Ezra Pound, 1885-1972, used free translation, playing variations upon the literally translated meaning, as another way of achieving this in such poems as The River Merchant's Wife, A Letter, which is taken from the Chinese, and Homage to Sextus Propertius, which adapts the Latin poet Propertius. The voice becomes a persona or mask, which enables the poet to explore a personality which might include some indistinguishable part of him or herself, but can range more freely, much as a dramatist can in creating a character. Such figures are T.S. Eliot's 1888 to 1965, Anxious, Fastidious, J. Alfred Prufrock, Pound's struggling poet, Hugh Selwyn Morberly, and W.B. Yeats's 1865 to 1939, Michael Robarts and Crazy Jane. Later in the century, some poets, or perhaps more accurately, some critics, came to see the casting off of any mask as a virtue in itself. For enthusiasts of what came to be called the confessional school of poetry, the manner of speaking should be open, easy, and even slangy. And the openness should reveal personal intensity and pain, as in The Abortion by the American poet Anne Sexton, 1926-74, which ends with the phrase, "This baby that I bleed." Major poems have been written by poets often lumped simplistically together as the confessional school of the 1950s and 1960s, usually taken to include John Berryman, Robert Lowell, and Sylvia Plath, as well as Sexton. However, the critical fashion has tended to insist that the success of the poetry depends upon the guarantee that the experiences in the poem are biologically true. The extremes of painful experience, abortion, madness, and suicidal impulse become seen to be the stuff of poetry. This is a perilous model, and in view of the distorted prominence given to the suffering and the suicides of Plath and Sexton, perhaps an especially dangerous one for women poets. The distinction between the self who writes and the self who appears in the poem is put well, I think, by John Berryman, 1914-72. Poetry is composed by actual human beings, and tracts of it are very closely about them. When Shakespeare wrote, in Sonnet 144, "Two loves I have of comfort and despair," reader, he was not kidding. But of course, the speaker can never be the actual writer, who is a person with an address, a social security number, debts, tastes, memories, expectations. Berryman, 1976. Pages 316 and 321. What is the language using us for? The broad assumption so far in this chapter has been that the poet chooses his or her tone of voice for a poem just as, hopefully, we choose when we speak and write in everyday life. But is this simply true? We have all had the experience of letting our tongue run away with us, so that once started on a way of speaking, sarcasm, for example, we say more than we mean because the force of that tone becomes irresistible. Similarly, we sometimes strike the wrong note, perhaps making a joke at the wrong time. In these instances, the tone we begin with seems to have a power all its own. This is surely part of the character of language. As we learn to speak and then to write, we learn language's component parts and how to put them together individually and creatively. But at the same time, we are absorbing many ways in which it has already been put together in set phrases, sayings, and associations. We also speak and write as others have done before us and around us. As we have noted, epic poets turned this to their advantage, but for poets like Wordsworth in the Romantic period and his successors, who set so much store by originality, the idea that our expression is not all ours has been quite discomforting. The 20th century philosopher, R.G. Collingwood, in his The Principles of Art, 1938, wrote this about emotion and expression.
Expressing emotions is certainly not the same thing as arousing them. There is emotion there before we express it, but as we express it, we confer upon it a different kind of emotional colouring. In one way, therefore, expression creates what it expresses.
For exactly this emotion, colouring and all, only exists so far as it is expressed. So, in a poem, the materials of language like vocabulary and syntax, the background noise we hear of preceding and contemporary language use, and especially how it has and is used in poetic convention, might drive the poem as much as the emotion or idea, which is there before we express it. It is this sense that language speaks us, rather than the other way round, that provoked W.S. Graham, 1918-86, to write,
"What is the language using us for?" said Malcolm Mooney, moving away, slowly over the white language. "Where am I going?" said Malcolm Mooney.
Certain experiences seem to not want to go into language, maybe, because of shame, or the reader's shame.
"Let us observe," said Malcolm Mooney.
Notice the little transgressions against the norms in these lines. The image of moving away over language, and its being called white. The absence of a question mark at the end of the first stanza. The awkwardness of the split infinitive over lines 5 and 6. Seem to not want to go into, and the split of into to mime the reluctance. These, following the slightly paranoid opening line, testify to Graham's sense of tussling with this force called language. Another of his poems, "Language, Ah, Now You Have Me," suggests the same unease. Here I am hiding in the jungle of mistakes of communication. This jungle is treacherous. Language, especially everyday language, is subject to the wear of custom, and words and phrases which once seemed pithy and exact lose their currency and become cliché. The attention to language that goes into the poetic space will always want to reject cliché in favour of new ways to speak. Moreover, that attention will also be aware of the echoing of history, social usage and connotation in language. All these things affect the tone we try to adopt. The poet both uses and is used by the conventions of the craft. The voice of the poem is both the poet's own and the voice of other poets. Beauty, writes Pound, is a brief gasp between one cliché and another. It makes writing poetry difficult, but not a reason to despair. Summary. In this chapter we have looked at what is meant by tone of voice in poetry, and how different registers in speech can be said to correspond to different poetic styles. The relationship of speech to poetry, and what we might mean by natural and unnatural style. The concept of the author's authority and authenticity in the poem. Public styles for poetry, narrative poetry and characterization. The epic and the idea of the muses in composition. Poems of anger and satire. The simple voice in poetry and the pastoral style. Poetry as personal expression, and the idea of the persona. The pressures of language on free expression.